Hi, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us for our continuing series of roundtable discussions on medical product safety surveillance. This is Mark McClellan with the team from the Brookings Institution here. And as you know, these sessions are meant to be interactive discussions of ongoing projects relevant to our shared interest in developing a national infrastructure for medical product safety surveillance. So we've had a whole series of these roundtables already. The topics are determined in large part by your areas of interest and by the opportunities that new initiatives around the country are making possible. And together, I think we can move forward more effectively on medical product safety surveillance. It's important in this effort, though, that the roundtables are dialogue. This is a discussion of recent projects, activities that are still underway and in process. So we're looking forward to hearing a lot of good questions and comments from all of you later in this call. So please listen to the presentation with that in mind. Today's roundtable is going to be an online web presentation. At this point, all of the phone lines should be muted automatically, but you can confirm that your phone or computer is muted. We would appreciate it. To mute your phone, you simply press star six to mute. To unmute your phone later when we get to the questions and discussions, press star seven. So unmute is star seven, mute is star six. And we encourage you to use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen if you're watching online. Submit questions at any time during the presentations. The questions go into a queue, and we'll then use that queue to call upon you to state your question and any comments you have along with it. If you have any technical problems, you can call our IT help desk at 202-797-6193. And that brings me to today's discussion. Today we're going to be talking about a study performed as part of the SAFE-RX project, which is a collaboration between the FDA and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to use Medicare data for active surveillance of medical products. Our lead presenter is going to be Dr. Judy Rakusin, who's the scientific lead of the Sentinel Initiative in the Office of Medical Policy at the Center for Drug Evaluation Research at FDA. Judy will talk about the study conducted in the Medicare database to evaluate the impact of lags in claims processing and claim information updates on real-time evaluation of drug safety signals. So as we've discussed on many occasions before, claims databases can be potentially an important source of information for safety surveillance, and there's none larger than the Medicare claims database, but there are these issues related to potential incompleteness of the data or inaccuracy of the data, especially when we try to use it rapidly in something close to real time for issues like surveillance of complications from vaccines and other timely public health studies. Following Judy's presentation, we'll have a few minutes for questions, and then we'll hear from two many Sentinel collaborators, Dr. Jeff Brown of Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute, and Dr. Jennifer Nelson of Group Health Research Institute and the University of Washington School of Public Health. They're going to make some additional comments regarding how the Mini Sentinel Coordinating Center, which is pulling together data from claims and other sources from a range of health plans, is evaluating similar issues to the Mini Sentinel distributed data set. So parallel issues, but from a health plan, a private health plan perspective. So again, remember that you can submit questions at any time during these presentations using the Q&A tab at the top of your screen, and we really encourage you to do so. And with that, I'd like to introduce Judy to begin the presentation today. And Judy, if you could make sure to press star 7 to unmute your phone, that would that'd be great.
How's that?
There we go.
Okay. Super. Thank you very much and for hosting this meeting today. I think it addresses a lot of challenges that we're facing as we think about how we might use these large administrative databases for near real-time active surveillance. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the SafeRx project and then go into the specifics of this study. I do have to ask one technical question, though, which is Sorry, it took me a second to figure out how to advance the slides. Okay, so just want to include the statement that this presentation represents the opinions of the authors and does not necessarily represent the views of FDA, CMS, and HHS. So the Medicare Part D prescription benefit data became available in May of 2008. Actually, the announcement was made on the same day, and I believe at the same ceremony that the Sentinel Initiative was launched at. And the SafeRx program evolved as a collaboration between FDA and CMS with early financial support from the HHS, Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. It was officially launched in June of 2008. And although this was a new effort, it really expanded on earlier, more informal collaborations between FDA and CMS that have been going on both within CBER, the Center for Biologics Evaluation Research, and CDER, the Center for Drug Evaluation Research, that was looking at both developing near real-time active surveillance methods and also providing opportunities to do more formal epidemiologic studies of medical product safety issues within Medicare and more recently Medicaid populations. So this slide, slide six, describes the different FDA groups that are participating in the SafeRx project. In some cases, there's more of a focus on active surveillance. In others, there's more formal epidemiology studies being conducted. And on this next slide, I want to mention a few of the projects that have produced either posters or papers, presentations at meetings, et cetera. With regard to the active surveillance project, there's been a lot of work coming out of CBER, who's been working with CMS and their contractor Acumen to look at surveillance for Guillain-Barré syndrome after influenza vaccination and developing some methods specifically to enable that. There have also been epidemiology studies that are being conducted, and including David Graham's, the study that he did along with other FDA, CMS, and Acumen collaborators looking at the risk of acute MI and other outcomes in users of the glitazones that was published in JAMA last summer. There's also a number of different drug use pattern studies that are being conducted in this data, some of which were presented at the ISBE meeting this last August. So there's a number of projects, publications, and posters coming out of this program, and we anticipate that there'll be many more. Today I want to focus in, though, on this particular study that we did, which also was presented at ISBE this past summer, that really focuses on potential challenges of using these large administrative claims databases for near real-time active surveillance. Particularly, we know that we're going to be able to need to access this data as quickly as possible to try and get the answers that we can in near real time, and really to complement some of the shortcomings of our current systems. We know from drug development programs we have limited numbers of patients that are being studied as far as looking at more, when we're concerned about more uncommon or rare adverse events. We also know that with regard to what is reported to our passive surveillance system, often they're under-reporting. There's a lack of denominator data. Sometimes the reports don't have as much detail as we need. And so we need other strategies to access this information that we need to understand these potential safety concerns. So administrative claims databases have been used probably for 30 years now for formal pharmacotherapy type studies and studies of other medical product adverse events, but not as much for active surveillance, although one exception would be the Vaccine Safety Data Link, a program of coming out of CDC that has looked at newly approved vaccines and potential adverse events over the last 5 years. And so as we looked at the Medicare database that we were going to be working with, we wanted to see, well, what would be the potential limitations that would hinder our efforts to look use this data in near real time. So I'll talk a little bit about the way the Medicare claims data is structured and what we have access to, highlight the potential data limitations that we wanted to examine, talk about how we investigated those data limitations, and wrap up with some conclusions. So the Medicare population, as you all know, is primarily the U.S. elderly over 65 and older. It also includes younger people who are disabled, have end-stage renal disease, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. Within the claims information, there's enrollment data that has demographic information. There's also information from Medicare Parts A and B that describes utilization of inpatient hospital care, outpatient institutional care, and that specifically refers to services that are obtained at a hospital as an outpatient, and doctor's visits. There's information on comorbidities, procedures, the occurrence of laboratory tests, although the specific results of those laboratory tests are not there or easily accessible. Physician information and payment information. Within the Part D prescription benefit, there's information on the specific prescription drugs, quantity dispensed, day supply, and information about prescriber and payment. The two specific data limitations that we looked at were claims adjudication and claims delay. Now, the most researchers, when they're accessing Medicare data, are accessing the standard analytical files that are released annually, and they are generally come out about 6 months after the end of a calendar year for Parts A and Part B, but the delay for the Part D data can be about 1 to 2 years. And so if a researcher is using that data, it's not going to be very useful for looking at near real-time issues that are emerging. In contrast, there are some CMS contractors, including Acumen, who we've been working with, who have access to the Common Working File and the Part D data that is released on for Part A and Part B. The updates are released on a weekly basis. For the prescription drug claims, those updates are released on a monthly basis. But because this data is evolving, a claims adjudication process needs to reconcile the multiple claims that may be present for the same set of services or drugs. So in that process, all claims that are seeking payment for the same set of services or drugs are grouped together, and a representative claim is selected from the group as being most accurate. But this is a dynamic composition of claims groups. Things are changing, and so the representative claim may change over time. This figure is intended to depict the two aspects, the claims delay and the claims adjudication. So if we look on the left side of the screen at time point A, that's when service A is rendered. And at some point after that service A is rendered, there's code group A, and that includes three claims submitted for service A, and one of those claims is selected as the representative claim at time R. The representative claim is referred to as R sub I here, and so this is occurring at T, R sub I. So the initial claim delay is just the time it takes for those claims to be submitted and one to to be selected as the representative claim. Now, further down the line, another claim may be added to that code group, and so there may be a new representative claim that's selected. So depending on how quickly one would want to look at this data, there may be changes that are going to occur subsequently. So one of our questions is how much information is changing, clinical information that's important to us as we're looking at a clinical question, how much of that information is changing between T sub RI versus T sub RF. And so that's what we aim to look at in our evaluation. So we try to quantify the impact of the claims adjudication and summarize the claim delay. And so we wanted to see how stable is the claim, is the clinical information in the claims data over time. And in order to do that, we measured the proportion of groups whose representative claims had information that changed across time. Now, for Part A and Part B for the Medicare, the fee-for-service claims, we looked at the year 2006, and we looked for changes in procedure and diagnosis fields as well as other fields through May of 2009. So there would have been, after the end of calendar year 2006, another 2.5 years almost to note for any changes that had occurred. And we looked at the inpatient hospital, the outpatient institutional, and again, that's services that a patient gets at a hospital, but as an outpatient, and then the physician's office. For the Part D component of this study, we looked at the prescription drug claims from 2007. Excuse me. And we used 2007 in particular because the program was just launched in 2006, and we were concerned that because of just the challenges of getting a new system up and running, that the time to submission of Part D claims in 2006 would not be a representative of what would happen once the system kind of got up and running and was moving smoothly. Excuse me. So within the Part D claims, we were looking at the NDC code, dosage, and date supply. And again, we looked through May of 2009. So after the end of calendar year 2007, there would have been another year and a half or so to detect changes. Okay, this is a busy slide. We're on slide 17. I just want to take a minute to orient you to this table after I finish coughing. Excuse me. So we have the claim setting on the left, the number of claims groups for each of those settings in the center, and the percentage of updated groups on the right. The first thing I want to point out here is that under each of the claim settings in bold, there's a line that says claims information updated. So of those claim settings, overall, how many are updated? And you can see that for inpatient, outpatient claims, and the physician office claims, that if we look at these second lines, we're talking about less than 10% have even any changes made to them. So it's about 9% in inpatient, 8% in outpatient, and 5% in the physician office. In contrast, there's more changes going on in the prescription drug claims. About a third had changes occur to them. But, of course, one of the questions that's important to us as well is that what is the information that's changing? So we can look here, and we see that in the right-hand column, we're looking at of the percent that are updated, which ones are the clinical information that would be of interest to us. So very small proportions of those are being changed. And if you look in the center column under the number of claims groups, you can actually see of all the claims that are submitted, what is the proportion that are affected by the changes to the clinical information. And you can see that it's generally less than 1% is affected. So, and that holds up across all the different claim settings. And the other thing that's very similar in all of these settings is that the charges, the payment component, is the most common group that is changing or reason for the change. And so if that were part of what we're focused on with these safe, near real-time safety evaluations, that, you know, could potentially be a problem. But really at this point, we're focusing on the clinical information, which is highly stable. With regard to the claim delay, we looked at the cumulative proportion of representative claims that were observed by the number of weeks after the, after each of those services were rendered. Again, for the Parts A and Part B fee-for-service claims, we looked at 2006, and for the same reason that I stated before, for the prescription drug claims, we looked at 2007. And you can see, first of all, on slide 19, that the inpatient, outpatient, and physician office, as I mentioned earlier, are updated weekly, and the prescription drugs are updated monthly. So that accounts for the different frequency of the tick marks along the curve. And you can see for the inpatient, outpatient, and physician's office that they're accruing very rapidly, so that by about a month out, there's more than 80% of the claims. And that is somewhat occurring somewhat slow, more slowly for Part D, so that it takes more like 4 months or so to get about 80% of the claims. Now, the motivation, of course, to get these in quickly is that the sooner they're submitted, the sooner they're paid, and so there is a motivation to get them in quickly. We think probably that if we were to rerun the prescription drugs for this past year, that it would probably look more similar to the inpatient, outpatient, and physician office claims, as in 2007 there was still probably some getting used to the system, and here we are a few years later, it's probably gotten to be smoother. So moving on to the our conclusions, what was notable to us is that the claims information was unchanged for over 90% of the diagnosis and procedure claims groups for the inpatient, outpatient, and physician office, and about 70% of the drug claim groups. So, so overall, there were relatively small numbers of claims that had any changes. But among the ones that did undergo adjudication, there was little impact on the clinical information over time. And really, that adjudication process most frequently updated the payment information. The representative claims accrued rapidly for the health services in, covered by Part A and Part B. The Part D claims were more delayed, as observed in 2000 for the experience in 2007. And so ultimately, we're left with a level of comfort for using this information in the Medicare database to look at near real time, or to do active surveillance and use this information in near real time to address safety issues that are emerging. Because the information, the clinical information that's most important for doing these kinds of evaluations really are quite stable. I want to acknowledge the study collaborators. Brown Parksema, who's at University of Florida, was with FDA working on the Sentinel Initiative on sabbatical a couple years ago and initiated this study with the SafeRx. And we certainly couldn't do it without our colleagues at Acumen and CMS.
Judy, thank you very much for the presentation. And I just want to remind everyone that we're going to have a couple of discussants who are going to extend some of these ideas to the Mini Sentinel program and really an even more broadly based approach to using health plan data. But before we do that, I wanted to pause to see if there are any specific questions on Judy's presentation related to Medicare data and the validity or accuracy of the of the claims that aren't yet fully adjudicated, which, as Judy emphasized, has some implications for the timely use of this information for safety surveillance and other public health purposes. While waiting to see if there are any questions on that, let me ask one, Judy, which is, it seems like you found a reasonably high degree of reliability. I would like to come back to your point about the claims information being unchanged in 90% of diagnosis and procedure claims, about 70% of drug claim groups. Even though that, the flip side of that is 10% and 30% respectively having changes, you didn't find any significant clinical impact of those changes. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Primarily, the changes were related to payment issues.
Right. And if these are, in fact, a potentially reliable source for active medical product surveillance, what's next for SafeRx? What's next up on the agenda?
Well, there's a number of projects across FDA that are working within the SafeRx effort, both in the active surveillance area, in vaccines and in drugs. And I think at this point, we are also, our work with CMS and Acumen is also incorporated into our federal partners collaboration, so which includes also the DOD and the VA, so that as we look at these the safety issues in the Medicare or Medicaid databases, we can also work with our federal partners and in understanding how these issues whether there's evidence of these potential problems in those databases as well. And I think, in feeling comfortable with the stability of this clinical information, it's probably going to be important for us to assess that in these other databases as well, so that, we can have feel comfortable with the findings that we're using.
So sounds like Sentinel, a version of Sentinel for federal partners. Interesting. Question for – go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think we'll have to see, we're in a pilot, and so, trying to understand what the priorities of the different federal partners are, identifying questions that we all have interest in getting answers to, and then understanding, how we can implement that, because there are differences in all of these systems.
I'd like to go to a question from Ken Hornbuckle, who points out that it's reassuring that the claims information, at least the clinically related information on the claims, is not changing over time. But he asks if there's been any assessment of the validity of the claims diagnosis codes, procedure codes, the drug codes themselves. So they are stable, but what's known about how accurately they reflect actual clinical conditions?
Right. So this particular project has not included, this project didn't include a validation component, but our other work with SafeRx and within the federal partners at this point has not included specific validation projects. And, we've talked about that, and certainly having the ability to go back to medical records to determine whether what we think we're looking at actually is occurring is an important component. but the procedures for being able to do that are still in development. So we recognize the importance of the validation component, but we haven't embarked on it as of yet.
Okay, well, thanks. I actually have a question from Jeff Brown, but since he's one of our discussants, this might be a good time to transition to the presentations related to mini-Sentinel from Jeff. And Jennifer Nelson. So just a reminder that you're first going to hear from Jeff Brown, who's an associate professor at the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School and also working at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute on a number of projects, including mini-sentinel. And then from Jennifer Nelson from the Biostatistics Unit at Group Health Research Institute, who's also an affiliate associate assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Washington. They're going to talk about some of these same and related issues from a mini-sentinel perspective. That's the collaborative effort, as many of you all know, of health plans working on safety surveillance issues. But one last thing before I turn this over to them is, let me just go ahead and turn it over. I think we're just looking at the time. So Jeff, if you could press *7 if you haven't already to unmute, and we'll look forward to hearing your presentation.
Great. So I think I unmuted. So you'll tell me when if you're not hearing me. So Mark, I think you gave me a promotion, which I'll just assume sticks, to associate professor. So I appreciate that. I can hold my question that I had for Judy to the end. I'll note that it's quite amazing. We did a similar study on data latency with I3 drug safety with Arnold and some others over there, and found about 88% within 2 months for influenza vaccinations. That was a study funded by CBER. That's in medical care. So that's it was kind of dead on. It was 2 months to get to 88%. We were again looking at something very specific. So I'm going to go quickly through how we're trying to address these issues within mini-sentinel, and I'll hand it over to Jennifer. I'm going to be talking more about the kind of the technical data issues that we're trying to handle, and then Jennifer will talk a little bit about the methodological approaches that you can implement. So we certainly don't expect the near real-time data to be stable within mini-sentinel. It should look about the same as what Judy presented. We know that it will be some variability. But we want to use the real-time data for the evaluation, so we have to figure this out. We certainly expect data latency to vary, kind of this data lag issue or just changes in the data, by data partner probably over time. So if we're looking at historical data, now it won't matter so much in the historical data unless you use the historical data to project forward. It'll also vary by setting, so inpatient, outpatient, ER, which is what Judy also was able to show. Obviously, there's the two issues that Judy brought up, which is one is the delay. It just takes a while for the claim to come through or for the care to show up, and the second issue being changes. So the question I had for Judy was more about the importance of the clinical changes that appeared in the CMS data. Was it a slight change at the five-digit level, or was it a big difference in a whole different clinical or condition? So that's I just tipped my hand to the question. So what are we going to do? So within mini-sentinel, during the next year, we're going to try to empirically test how our data partners. How the data in the data partners change over time. So part of our year two, which started a week ago, will be asking the data partners to do their data updates in a way that allows us to look at how the data change update to update. So basically we're going to be asking them to do overlapping data extracts so that I can look at what November 2010 looked like in December, and then again see what November 2010 looked like in March, and you can kind of go forward doing that. That will allow us to take a look at both the delay in claims coming through, it's that time between service date and when we actually see it in the database, and will also allow us, using our data model, it'll be unique to how we handle our data, how encounters change, meaning, how are diagnoses added or taken away from particular encounters, which is really mimicking what the study Judy presented. We, of course, always have the ability for any particular study to limit the study to specific time windows. So knowing that the most recent data are unstable, then in a particular evaluation, you simply have to make this decision of, is it important enough to use the data, the most recent data that I know are a little unstable, or do I just lop that off and look a little bit farther in the past, knowing that it's stable? And that's just a decision that has to get made depending on the question you're asking. So we expect this will be, for Mini Sentinel, it's going to be basically an ongoing process. I don't expect that in 2011 we'll simply learn the answer and then go with it. We'll work with our data partners to come up with the best approach. I think this next year it's really investigational to do some empirical testing. From what we learn, we'll come up with for the next year and forward a reasonable approach so that we can keep, one, monitoring how the data are changing, because I expect that as providers try to get the bills in quicker, things might change, and as, I don't know, health insurers might not want to pay the bills any faster. So I don't know how they'll change, but I think it's something that we'll have to keep monitoring with all of our data partners. We have a lot of different data partners, and they have different systems, and every change in an underlying system might impact this. So we'll really have to pay attention to it the whole time that we're doing for every update throughout Mini Sentinel. There's just too many ways that the data can change, the underlying data change that can cause us trouble. So I got to congratulate Judy and her team for doing something that's really is very helpful. It really helps frame the issue. It's just the problem won't be going away. We're going to have to keep monitoring. So with that, I think I can hand over to Jennifer, who can give the other approaches to dealing with this.
Sure. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Jeff. I'm sure that promotion will be coming soon. And Jennifer, if you can press *7 on mute, that'd be great.
Okay. I'm assuming everyone can hear me if I've pressed correctly. So I have three general comments about how Mini Sentinel is going to will plan to be evaluating similar issues to those that Judy described in her presentation with regard to data lags and the impact on the Mini Sentinel surveillance efforts. So first, just sort of reiterating what Jeff just says, I think one of the most important things is to simply learn as much as possible about the nature and type of the data lags that can occur when using the data sources, the healthcare utilization databases that are dynamically being updated in real time, and to learn from prior and ongoing studies like the Medicare data evaluations by SafeRx. And for me, a lot of the learning that I've done has come through the vaccine safety data link experience. So learning as much as possible, that's number one. Number two, for a given safety question that we might want to address, be it something as simple as an administrative question or a scientific one, I think it's important to have a good understanding, given what we learn about the lags and the issues that can be introduced, learn about the impact of those in terms of the direction and the magnitude of the bias that can exist and that those lags can introduce. And in particular, knowing that, weighing that risk, so the potential magnitude of the bias against the benefit, which is knowing something sooner versus later. And do that in the context of the specific question that you're asking, and that can guide us in terms of determining how soon we want to use the data for that particular purpose. And as Jeff mentioned, I think different questions that we may ask may warrant looking sooner, so somewhat higher risk, and some may require more mature data. And thirdly, I think whenever data are analyzed, it's going to be important to apply both database strategies, so things that we can do at the design phase, as well as methods-based strategies, things at the analysis phase, to control and minimize these potential biases. And more than likely, a multi-tiered approach, the one that engages several of these strategies together, is going to help protect us maximally against the biases that can be introduced. And the other piece of that, when you apply a strategy, is to know the assumptions that are involved in applying that and the limitations of that approach so you can interpret the results accordingly. I did want to mention, in addition to just sort of those three general comments, giving some specifics. So in particular, with regard to number one, learning as much as possible. So I wanted to just highlight a few things we've learned in the context of the Vaccine Safety Data Link Project, and as well as the PRISM Project, which evaluated H1N1 safety last fall. And I want to acknowledge Sharon Green, who's from Harvard Pilgrim, who has really done a lot of the thinking on this and explored some of these issues in the most depth.
But number one, as Jeff said, data lags can vary by site. They can vary by visit type, be it outpatient, ED, or inpatient, data source, and over time. Recent system changes at Group Health, for example, caused a big difference in how fast data were observed at our site. Secondly, we've learned, not surprisingly, the delays are generally shortest for integrated healthcare systems with well-developed electronic health records, and delays are longest for sites that use insurance claims to identify inpatient diagnoses. Another lesson is if a data source is not timely and complete, then it's going to be important to do adjustments for these data accrual lags, and potentially these adjustments, in fact, I would argue, should be tailored to each source to best avoid bias, particularly bias that would bias us away from detecting a safety problem. Another piece of information we've learned is problems due to lags can present themselves in many different ways. We've been talking today about the lags, so slowly arriving data or data that may change due to updates. That's sort of the obvious one. But in addition, enrollment files are files that may not be that may get updated, or we may different data holders may update those files with different frequencies, and the results of that can be more interesting. So people, for example, exposures and events can disappear because if you update your enrollment, you may have people who are no longer enrolled, and that information would potentially go away after the updating of that enrollment file. So those are some examples of things we've learned. And then I just wanted to touch on a few specific things that we have done and can do and should do some more thinking about to minimize bias. So most basically, a simple data-based approach is to just simply wait a few more weeks before we use those data from a different source. And we have routinely applied that strategy within the Vaccine Safety Data Link, for example, waiting 8 weeks or even 12 weeks before conducting analyses. Additionally, at the analysis phase, so I'll give two examples here. If we have a historically controlled design, so we're comparing observed number or rate of adverse events among new users of a drug or vaccine compared to an expected number or rate of events based on historical information, a simple strategy that can be applied is to simply adjust the expected number depending on a specific site and a specific data source, the proportion of data that we've estimated to have accrued in the observed data. Not recognizing that in the observed data we may not observe everything and adjust the expected counts in a similar way. Another setting in which we've applied some strategies, simple solutions, is in a self-controlled case series design. So here we're comparing the number or rate of adverse events between a post-vaccination and a control window of time within the same person. Now here we have two windows, and what varies between those windows is time, and that's exactly how we know the data may vary. And so in this instance, you could do something more conservative, like adjusting based on each site's setting-specific data and only include the information from that data source if it's 90% complete, so requiring nearly complete accrual to avoid an imbalance when you're comparing the risk and control windows. And then one other strategy I just wanted to mention, and this is something we did more recently within the Vaccine Safety Data Link in a group sequentially monitored setting. And so this was also a historical control design. We're comparing observed number and rate of adverse events to an expected rate based on historical information. And like many of the vaccine safety studies we've conducted, we've lagged the data by 8 weeks. And then in addition to that, we're conducting a sensitivity analysis that is designed to give us an understanding and a better sense of what residual data delays may exist beyond that, and do an analysis in two different ways to see how those analyses might differ depending on how we treat those lags. And so one analysis involves, at any given look at the data, we cumulatively refresh all the information from the beginning of the study. So we allow all the dynamic information to come in. A second approach is instead to freeze the previously analyzed data and simply add the new data since the last time you performed a test. And so this gives us a way of understanding how the data are changing, and in particular, the big picture, which is how do our relative risk estimates change, and how does how do our test results change depending on how we analyze that information. So those are just some examples. And I think the bottom line is if you do these three things, if you learn as much as possible about the lags, understand the direction and magnitude of the bias that can be introduced, and take steps to mitigate that bias, you can more safely look earlier and improve potentially the timeliness of safety surveillance because you'll be able to better understand your results and their potential limitations.
Jennifer, thanks for the presentation. Jeff, thanks as well. Maybe let me start off a discussion with putting you both on the spot. You just went through both some of the limitations with mini-sentinel data and how these limitations may differ for different source data, but it sounds like from your presentation that these limitations are fairly well understood. You just went through a few best practices for using the data. So are we at the point where data like these should be a part of kind of routine surveillance, and are there any particular caveats to add to that?
So I can go first. So Mark, I think we can use the data. I think you're exactly right. We understand where to look. So the biggest fear is the unknown, not knowing what you don't know. And I think here we know what we don't know, and because of that we can address it. We have to be pragmatic and careful about it, but I think we know an awful lot about how to use it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we've learned a lot, and I think we do need to be vigilant because these, even though as Jeff said, we know where to look, but I think the type of lags and the different things we may see may change over time, and so we're always going to want to be looking to make sure that we understand what we see and how to interpret our results. You know, we need to have the context for understanding how to interpret these results, so being cautious will always be the case.
Okay, thank you. Judy, let me come back to you and see if you've got a response to Jeff's questions earlier about where the clinical data did change in the Medicare claims, how significant were the changes, and then if you've got anything to add about this last broad topic of some of the implications of all these studies for actually using these claims data sources for some surveillance studies. Judy, if you're on mute, be sure to press *7.
Okay. I actually just unmuted myself so that I can throw it to my Acumen colleagues. Jonathan Gibbs and Farzana Ali, who probably more easily in front of them have the breakdowns of, even though those were relatively small proportions of patients who did have changes to the clinical information, do you guys have handy the details of what was changing?
We're looking for it now. This is Jonathan Gibbs, by the way. We did look at whether conditions were going from diagnoses were changing at the fifth digit level as contrasted with the third digit level, for example, is it becoming more specific in terms of what type of acute myocardial infarction a person have relative to switching from that to something completely different. And let me see if I can pull that up really quick. My sense was that on the order of a quarter of changes were changes like that from a less specific diagnosis to a more specific diagnosis, while the remaining three quarters were changes of to something completely different.
Okay, thanks. And Judy, any comments on the broader topic of utility of these approaches for actually doing surveillance on a more routine basis now?
I think that we, these are the data that we have access to, and I think that this study allows us to feel more confident about using them. So we've been using them in some smaller projects, and I know this work has been going on for some time in CBER looking at influenza vaccine, and I think that this information helps us to have even more confidence that it's a valuable data to be looking in. So I think we will be continuing to use it and try, you know, we're working within the Federal Partners Collaboration to develop some templates for trying to be able to put these evaluations in a more kind of timely and efficient way so that as we go through each one, we can understand the even the lessons in just putting these together, thinking about the potential biases that might emerge, you know, related to these potential changes that might still occur in some small degree, and be able to use that as we, you know, increase the number of the kinds of evaluations we'd like to be doing.
Okay, thanks. And now just as the slide up on your screens says, just a reminder that you can either hit the Q&A tab for asking a question or just let us know that you want to ask one or press star 7 to unmute. I'd like to start with a question or go next to a question from Marietta Anthony. So, Marietta, if you could press star 7 and go ahead with your question. Okay, well, while if we're not going to hear from Marietta, another question that we received electronically is asking for a bit more detail on the on what kinds of checks or you know, again, just getting back to this question of the underlying validity of the claims information. Are there checks that are performed on the source data to help assure their reliability? I know there are a number of checks related to payment accuracy issues. I wonder if any of you might comment more specifically on that, either from the Medicare standpoint or the health plan standpoint.
Well, it's Judy. I'll just comment that, you know, we recognize that this validating claims data is an important component of using this kind of data for active surveillance. So within the Mini Sentinel project, we have a large effort in the first year of doing systematic reviews of 20 health outcomes of interest to understand what's been published as far as validation studies for those health outcomes of interest, like, just for example, CHF, anaphylaxis, stroke, et cetera, and trying to at least capture, well, what do we know, what has been validated so far, and where is their consistency? Because there's always going to be issues about different data sources, and if you validate one data source, is that representative of another one? And so, you know, we recognize the potential shortcomings of just relying on, you know, one study, but trying to look across, you know, the literature and the body of evidence for given, you know, for 20 health outcomes of interest to understand, you know, has this been adequately validated? Recognizing that there will be some that really haven't been and might need to be, but also trying to make use of what we have learned. So that's an area of continuing interest in. OMOP has done some work in that area in addition to the work that's going on in Mini Sentinel. So it's certainly going to be an area that we're going to continue to be working on. As I mentioned within Medicare, we're still trying to, develop some procedures for doing that because it's a little bit complicated with the way things are set up.
Okay, and one other related question that came in from Henry DeMaray is whether it's been possible to look at the sort of doing some clinical validity checks by looking across different sources of information within the claims database. So, for example, Is there, do we know if there's a high level of agreement between diagnostic and other information coming from physician claims versus hospital claims, at least for utilization that's serious enough to rate a hospital stay, or you know, many of the other validation studies involving claims data look at consistency of claims over time. If there's a chronic disease or something like that, it might not show up in just one claim. Do those kinds of studies apply here? Have they been done here?
So they haven't been done, but, you know, we definitely see a role for taking that kind of approach to try and where we don't have easy access to the source records to look to see whether a series of diagnoses or procedures or medications hang together, you know, to support that particular diagnosis. So I think that's certainly something that we envision doing, and within OMOP we've talked about doing that, some of that work as well.
All right, thanks. We've got just a little bit more time left. I see a question from Hong Cheng. So if you're still with us, please feel free to press star 7 to ask your question. And if not, maybe just one other wrap-up question. So we've talked a lot about claims data sources, but you know, obviously part of the surveillance strategy here, both for SafeRx using federal data and for Sentinel, is to move to incorporating additional clinical sources of information. Is there would you all have any comments about how this these studies based on claims fit with moving on to perhaps more clinically enriched surveillance?
So this is Jeff. So it's going to be incredibly important, certainly in MiniSentinel, the strategy is this, to be bringing on these more clinically rich data sources. There's for our population, we'll be able to have more and more clinically rich data. And I think there's a lot of ways it helps, and one, you know, some very specific ways. If you have a lab, you know, that might help you define that outcome even more precisely. And OMOP's done is doing this kind of work also of the best way to define one of these outcomes. So the more clinically rich data you have access to, the more confident you can be in defining those outcomes. So it's an important avenue for us to keep going down and to understand those data, the good and the bad and the ugly about those data sources as well.
And Judy, I know Medicare is getting some clinically enriched information submitted for quality measures and you know, various performance initiatives, pay for performance approaches. Any implications for at least the short term plans for the federal side of this safety surveillance?
I'm not as familiar with the ways in which the Medicare data may be enriched in that regard. I don't know if Jonathan or Farzana want to add anything there. But our other federal partners, VA and DOD, do have access to more electronic health record-based information. So it's certainly something that we could look into with them.
Okay, well, thanks. I want to thank all of our presenters for some very interesting work as well as discussion, and clearly a lot is happening using claims administrative data for safety surveillance, and very important thing for all of us to hear about post-market safety surveillance. So we'll look forward to next steps, and I hope we'll also look forward to our next roundtable webinar, which is going to take place later this month, October 22nd, from noon to 1 Eastern time. That webinar is going to discuss what's been learned from the PRISM project. This is PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, a coordinated federal strategy to monitor the safety of the 2009 H1N1 influenza vaccine vaccine using observational data from large health plans. The presenters there are going to be Dan Salmon from HHS, Richard Platt from Harvard and the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute, and Robert Ball from the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research at FDA. Another obviously related topic to what we talked about today, and we hope you'll be able to join us then. In addition to thanking all of our presenters for their work today, we want to thank all of you who sent in questions and all of you who participated. We'll look forward to joining you again soon. Thank you very much.